Welcome to the Lowdown. This is an AI-generated open-source news summary for general informational awareness. This product is not intended for use as official intelligence. The views expressed here are solely those of the cited authors and do not reflect the official policy or position of the Department of War, the United States Air Force, or any other U.S. government agency.
Iran and its allied proxies are currently leveraging ceasefire negotiations in Lebanon to deflect from core strategic goals, such as securing operational control over the Strait of Hormuz. Simultaneously, Russian leadership is maintaining a public posture of economic and logistical stability despite verified Ukrainian deep strikes causing localized fuel shortages and a growing federal deficit. In occupied territories, Russian authorities are accelerating demographic and administrative integration through the deportation of minors, youth militarization programs, and economic incentives.
Okay, so you just heard the formal bottom line up front there, but we really want to unpack what that intelligence actually means for you on the ground. We are looking at a massive stack of operational reporting today from June 4th, 2026.
Yeah, it's a lot.
It is, and it covers both the Middle East and the Russian theaters. But the overarching theme today, I think, is really, it's kind of the incredible, almost unbelievable art of geopolitical smoke and mirrors.
Oh, absolutely. It really is a masterclass in misdirection, because you're going to see how a country boasts about record economic growth while its own citizens are, you know, rationing just a few liters of gas.
Right.
And how this mafia-style protection racket plays out on the international maritime stage.
Yeah. So let's start with the Middle East, because the intelligence there highlights a very deliberate strategy of asymmetric distraction, specifically with what's happening right now with the ceasefire negotiations in Lebanon.
Right. So to give you the context, on June 3rd, the U.S., Israel, and Lebanon put forward this joint statement, and they proposed a ceasefire framework. The deal basically says Hezbollah halts all its attacks, they withdraw their forces south of the Litani River, and then the Lebanese armed forces.
Which is the official state military.
Exactly. The LAF moves in to secure that zone. And reportedly, the Lebanese state forces have already started deploying to some of these southern areas. So it sounds like a viable off-ramp.
It does, but Hezbollah and Iranian leadership have just completely flatlined it. Like, Hezbollah's Secretary General, Naim Qassem, came out on June 4th and said agreeing to this framework would be tantamount to surrender.
Right.
And he, along with top Iranian leaders, I mean, we're talking guys like Brigadier General Esmail Ghani from the Quds Force, they are demanding total Israeli capitulation instead.
Which, just to be clear, that means Israel would have to entirely cease military operations and withdraw, completely abandoning their stated political objective of dismantling Hezbollah.
Which they know Israel is never going to agree to.
Never. So why demand something so blatantly impossible? The analytical interpretation here is that Iran and Hezbollah's maximalist demands are the deliberate strategy of deflection. By keeping the Lebanon situation red hot and intractable, Iranian officials are essentially buying time.
They're stalling.
Yeah, they are deferring and deflecting international focus away from negotiations with the U.S. regarding their core strategic goals. Mainly, you know, their nuclear program and their aggressive push to control the Strait of Hormuz.
I really love that framing, because it's essentially like, it's like setting a massive, highly visible fire in your neighbor's front yard so the authorities are too busy to notice the illegal casino you're running out of your back door.
That is a perfect analogy. And if we look at what they are doing at that back door in the Strait of Hormuz, the audacity is just striking. On June 4th, Iran's Deputy Foreign Affairs Minister, Kazim Gharibabadi, claimed that Iran is fully complying with the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea.
Wait, complying?
Complying.
Yeah.
His exact phrasing was that Iran is merely offering services and protection to vessels moving through their waters.
Okay, wait, protection. That sounds exactly like a mob boss smashing the windows of your storefront with a baseball bat and then casually walking in the next day to sell you glass protection insurance.
Well, the intelligence essentially assesses it exactly that way. It is a state-sponsored protection racket. I mean, Iran frequently uses kinetic force. We're talking naval mines, direct drone strikes, boardings to compel commercial shipping to navigate through their specific territorial waters.
Right.
And once those vessels are cornered, Iranian authorities claim the legal right to extract a fee to protect them from the very attacks Iran is orchestrating.
That is just wild.
It is. And they are actively trying to isolate the U.S. from intervening by straining U.S. Gulf relations.
Yeah.
which we saw with the recent June 2nd missile and drone strikes targeting Kuwait and Bahrain.
Yeah, that regional influence is a huge factor. Mm-hmm. And speaking of Iran's regional influence, we should shift slightly to Iraq here, because the reporting shows the Iraqi federal government is attempting to rein in Iranian-backed militias by integrating them into the state security apparatus. We saw the prominent Shia cleric, Muqtada al-Sadra, announce he's dissolving his militia, Saraya al-Salam, so they can join the state forces. And the Iraqi prime minister, Ali al-Zaidi, has this massive plan to fold 35,000 disarmed militia members directly into formal institutions like the Counterterrorism Service.
Which I'm sure you can guess brings up a massive operational risk. The Counterterrorism Service, or CTS, is a highly capable force that receives significant funding and support from the United States.
Right. And here's where it gets really interesting and, frankly, a bit alarming. From an analytical perspective, what is the operational risk here? If the Iraqi government takes 35,000 guys whose primary allegiance has been to Iranian-backed networks and just gives them new uniforms in a U.S.-funded agency, aren't we just subsidizing Iranian infiltration into the Iraqi state?
You've hit the nail on the head. The ISW assessment explicitly warns that integrating these entities without definitively severing their command and control links to Tehran will likely further embed Iranian influence into the very core of the Iraqi security establishment.
Wow.
It's reflagging, not reforming.
Right. Although we should flag for you that this whole integration plan is highly fluid and entirely unverified at this stage. It's a developing claim. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the hardline militias within the Islamic resistance in Iraq are flatly refusing to play ball.
Yeah, Kataib Hezbollah publicly stated on June 4th, they won't disarm a single fighter until all foreign troops are out of Iraq.
Exactly. So whether Prime Minister Zaidi can actually pull off this integration is a massive question mark right now.
It is. It's a very delicate balancing act of appearances versus reality, mm-hmm. which actually provides a very natural transition into our reporting on the Russian theater of operations.
Yeah.
Because if Iran is using diplomatic proxy stalling as their smoke and mirrors, Russia is currently heavily reliant on economic and administrative facades to mask their kinetic reality.
Oh, absolutely. The contrast here is just jarring. Because on one hand, you have Ukrainian President Zelensky issuing an open letter to Putin on June 4th, offering a very pragmatic off-ramp. He proposed an immediate frontline ceasefire, a face-to-face meeting in a neutral country, and an all-for-all prisoner of war exchange.
Right.
And how does Russia respond? They ignore the reality of the front lines and instead host the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum to essentially put on a financial magic show.
A magic show is a good way to put it. The claims coming out of that forum were quite something. You had high-level officials, like the presidential administration deputy head Maxim Orushkin and finance minister Anton Silanov, standing at the podium claiming the Russian economy has grown by 10% over the last 3 years.
Right.
They boasted about having the world's lowest unemployment rate and claimed real income growth has skyrocketed over 24%.
Okay, so 24% real income growth sounds fantastic on paper, but what is the actual mechanism driving that? Because the intelligence paints a much bleaker picture of what's really happening under the hood there.
Yeah, the mechanism is wartime desperation. That remarkably low unemployment rate they're bragging about. It's not a sign of a booming, healthy job market. It's indicative of a severe, crippling labor shortage.
Oh.
Because when you pull hundreds of thousands of working-age men out of the economy and send them to the front lines, while simultaneously suffering massive brain drain from citizens fleeing the country, you literally run out of workers.
So to keep the defense factories running, they have to offer astronomically high wages just to poach the few remaining workers from the civilian sector.
Exactly. It's wage inflation disguised as prosperity.
Oh, I see.
And it is choking out the civilian economy. The broader macroeconomic data reflects this reality. The state is facing a federal budget deficit of nearly $80 billion just in the first 5 months of 2026.
$80 billion?
Yeah. Even the CEO of VTB Bank, Andrei Kostin, publicly admitted that high borrowing costs are stifling capital investment and could lead to total economic stagnation this year.
So they are bleeding cash to keep the defense sector afloat while the actual logistical infrastructure of the country is literally on fire. Because the intelligence details an incredibly effective intermediate and long-range strike campaign by Ukraine right now.
Yes, it does.
Just over the course of June 3rd and 4th, verified Ukrainian deep strikes hit the elastic propellant plant in Ryazan, the Michurinsk Progress plant in Tambov, the St. Petersburg oil terminal, and the Saratov oil refinery. Ukraine is methodically dismantling Russia's energy and logistics spine.
They are. And Russia's kinetic response overnight on June 3rd to 4th was an attempted overwhelming package. They launched one Iskander-M ballistic missile and 293 drones.
Wow.
However, Ukrainian air defenses reportedly intercepted and downed 264 of those drones, which significantly blunted the impact.
Yeah, that's a huge interception rate. And while all this is happening, the Russian Ministry of Defense is out making flashy announcements. Defense Minister Andrei Belousov said they are testing a brand new battle management information system with their central grouping of forces. And he specifically noted they plan to fully deploy this system during the Center 2026 strategic exercises, which involves their international partners from the Collective Security Treaty Organization, or CSTO. So what is the operational intent here? Why roll out your most sensitive new internal command network to foreign partners? Are they just trying to secure export sales?
Well, it's far more strategic than just a sales pitch.
Yeah.
The ISW assessment is that the Russian military command wants to use this shared information environment to integrate foreign CSTO military contingents directly into a unified Russian operational command structure.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it's about absorbing allied forces into their own nervous system, essentially operationalizing them under Moscow's direct control.
Which is fascinating when you consider that on the actual front lines right now, they aren't making any real progress. The intelligence confirms zero verified advances by either side over this reporting period.
But zero.
Instead, we are seeing a heavy reliance on cognitive warfare. Just kind of like TikTok warfare, really.
Oh, yeah.
For instance, there was geolocating footage of the Russian 114th Motorized Rifle Regiment raising a flag in Huyapilsky, but Ukrainian Southern Defense Forces explicitly flagged this as an unverified demonstrative staging.
Yeah, it's just a produced video shot on the outskirts, meant to project momentum, not an actual military seizure.
Exactly.
And we see a similar pattern with claims from Russian sources about a semi-encirclement of Ukrainian forces in Kostantinivka. The intelligence assesses these as nothing more than unverified, small-scale infiltration missions. They do not represent a consolidated forward line or a genuine tactical encirclement.
Right, it is projection over presence.
Precisely.
We've covered the kinetic facades and the economic facades, but where this gets deeply unsettling is when we transition to the Russian occupation updates. Because once the front line moves, the administrative and demographic engineering really begins. And the contradictions in their official messaging here are just glaring.
They absolutely are, particularly concerning the deportation of Ukrainian children. On May 7th, you had the Russian Federal Commissioner for Children's Rights, Maria Lvova-Belova, issue a formal report explicitly denying that Russia has any adoption program for children taken from occupied areas.
But then, just 3 weeks later, on May 27th, the Luhansk Occupation Commissioner, Inna Schwenk, gives an interview where she openly admits her office placed 24 children from occupied Luhansk directly into Russian families in 2026 alone.
Yeah.
She even cited a presidential decree that mandates a 30% reduction in orphanage populations by 2030. They are literally issuing bureaucratic quotas to absorb another nation's youth.
And the financial logistics backing this up are staggering. The administration in Rostov Oblast alone allocated over 1.37 billion rubles for their 2026 summer camp program.
1.37 billion.
Yes. That money is being used to temporarily deport over 5,600 children from occupied Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia for quote-unquote re-education and societal integration. And we're also seeing transfers to occupied Crimea.
And they are weaponizing the social safety net to force demographic shifts among adults, too. In occupied Kherson, they introduced a 100,000 ruble maternity capital payment for families having a third child.
Right.
But the catch is the intelligence identifies this as a coercive tool to force Russian passportization, because you can only get the money if you hold Russian citizenship. They are literally trying to buy demographic loyalty.
And for the youth that remain in the occupied territories, the focus is intense militarization. We are seeing the institutionalization of youth movements like Unarmia, which now claims 7,000 enrolled youths in occupied Donetsk.
Wow, 7,000.
Yeah, they've also revived the Soviet era, Tsarnaetsa 2.0 military patriotic games, having hundreds of students in Kherson and Luhansk run through tactical medicine and drone operation drills. They even have Rosgvardia, which is Russia's heavily armed internal security force, interacting directly with kids at local youth festivals.
Okay, here's the ultimate paradox I need you to help me square. We just talked about an $80 billion federal deficit.
Right.
We talked about how their oil refineries are systematically being blown up by Ukrainian strikes. Yet the Occupation Administration is out here handing out 100,000 ruble maternity bonuses and offering massive real estate subsidies like 2% preferential mortgages. How on earth do they fund that while basic logistics are failing?
Well, they do it by simply ignoring the failing logistics. It all comes back to the facade of normalcy. The occupation administrators are desperate to project the image of a highly capable, legitimate governing body. So they pour money into these highly visible social programs while deliberately obscuring the wartime reality right outside their windows.
And the reality is that they literally cannot keep the gas tanks full. In occupied Crimea, major gas companies like Etan and TES have completely suspended the sale of fuel coupons to individuals.
Yeah.
In Sevastopol, at the start of June, authorities were strictly rationing gas only for emergency services. And over in Luhansk, they instituted a hard limit of 20 liters of fuel per person. And I'm guessing they aren't telling their citizens this because Ukraine is hitting their logistics hubs.
No. Definitely not. Russian occupation officials are falsely attributing these severe shortages to rising civilian demand.
Rising demand.
Yeah, they will say anything to avoid acknowledging the success of the Ukrainian strike campaign or the inherent illegitimacy of their occupation.
Which brings us to the darkest part of that illegitimacy, really the legal repressions. Mm. Because the intelligence documents how they are abusing the judicial system to target both combatants and civilians. Take the case of Valery Osochenko.
Right.
He's a Ukrainian soldier from the 157th Separate Mechanized Brigade who was taken as a prisoner of war. Occupation authorities indicted him on terrorism charges, falsely claiming he was part of the Adar Battalion, which is a group Russia unilaterally designated as a terrorist organization.
Which is a profound violation of international law. Prosecuting a lawful combatant under domestic terrorism legislation is a direct breach of the Third Geneva Convention. And it's not just soldiers. Occupation courts are handing down draconian sentences to civilians on incredibly tenuous charges. For example, Anna Belyaeva, a civilian whose husband was killed fighting in Mariupol in 2022, was recently sentenced to 14 years in a penal colony for alleged espionage.
14 years?
Yes. It is a systematic campaign of legal terror designed to crush any remaining dissent.
So to synthesize all of this, because we've covered so much ground today, what is the ultimate operational significance of this intelligence?
Well, to deliver a formal neutral summary of the briefing's operational significance, what the intelligence clearly demonstrates is that both the Middle Eastern and Russian theaters are heavily reliant on asymmetrical tactics to achieve their strategic objectives.
Right.
In the Middle East, Iran is utilizing proxy diplomatic stalling, specifically through Hezbollah's maximalist demands to defer negotiations and secure maritime control in the Strait of Hormuz. Meanwhile, in the European theater, the Russian Federation is leveraging demographic engineering, child deportations, and a meticulously crafted facade of economic stability to sustain a protracted conflict amidst severe logistical degradation.
Yeah, it's a sobering reality to process.
It is, and it leaves you with this final provocative thought to consider. We are watching state actors officially integrate extra-legal armed proxy forces into their permanent national security apparatuses, as we see developing in Iraq.
Yeah.
At the same time, we are watching the heavy, systematic militarization of civilian youth populations in occupied territories. When states deliberately blur the lines between official state military, deniable proxy militia, and civilian youth, how will that alter the future landscape of international conflict resolution for generations to come?
That is a heavy, critical question to leave on. Thank you for joining us as we unpack this operational overview. This concludes today's deep dive briefing from The Lowdown.